This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we focus on the writings of women on nature. Our guest is writer Brenda Peterson. Together with Linda Hogan, she is co-editor of The Sweet Breathing of Plants, Women Writing on the Green World. The book is a collection of essays, stories, and poems written by women from all walks of life, including poets, novelists, journalists, a psychologist, a naturalist, a biochemist, and a veterinarian. In The Sweet Breathing of Plants, readers will find selections by Isabel Allende and Zora Neale Hurston, Jane Goodall and Rachel Carson, and Diane Ackerman, as well as our guest, Brenda Peterson. The book is the second in a trilogy on women and the natural world. This volume follows intimate nature, the bond between women and animals. Listeners, join us with your questions and comments. Share with us your thoughts about the connections between people and plants. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Brenda Peterson is the author of three novels, two collections of essays, and numerous articles. She joins us this afternoon from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. Brenda Peterson, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Celeste.
In the preface to the book, you and Linda write, "Plants are fundamental to who we are." You want to expand on that thought?
We are hunter-gatherers. I think even those of us who live in cities have a relationship with plants. When I was in New York working at the New Yorker magazine in my 20s, I had a midget vegetable garden on the 22nd floor, and it was covered with soot. Nevertheless, it did yield little tiny, tiny beans and peas and tomatoes. So they can take the country out of us, but we really don't get too far away. No matter where we go, we are these people who are born and bred on plants. It is perhaps one of our very first associations.
Hmm. Was that a rough stint for you living in New York?
Perhaps one of the very roughest.
Because I know that you grew up out west, surrounded by the mountains, Mother Nature.
I grew up on a forest lookout station in the Plumas National Forest on the High Sierras, and there were very few people, about 10 of us up there, about a million acres of wilderness and many, many other species who I imprinted on at quite an early age, including the evergreen and the pine and the ponderosa pine. And my father, who's mixed blood, would explain to me that these were called the standing people. They were alive. They were all part of an extended family.
Yeah. As I mentioned, there's an essay of yours here in the collection. It's called Killing Our Elders. And I just want to read the opening paragraph. As a small child growing up on a Forest Service lookout station in the High Sierras, I believe the encircling tribe of trees were silent neighbors who protectively held the sky up over our rough cabins. For all their soaring, deep stillness, the ponderosa pines and giant Douglas firs often made noises in the night, a language of whispers and soft whistles that sang through the cabin's walls. That's really lovely.
Thank you.
What other memories from childhood do you have of being a child in the High Sierras?
Well, I wrote about this a lot in my latest book, which is called Build Me an Ark, A Life with Animals. And I think because I had the great good fortune to be raised with the perspective of humans so humble and slight compared to the natural world, the trees, the great old-growth forest that had not fallen yet, and the other animals that were there except for the wolf on the forest, I was given the opportunity to really experience what native peoples must have known, what our ancestors must have known, and the balance of nature was very much intact when I was born 50 years ago on that forest. And because the animals were, again, part of our extended family and much greater than the few humans who are up there, I really looked to them as teachers, I looked to them as way showers, and I began to realize no matter where I went in my life that there was always an animal at every turning point in my life, whether it was the wild wolf in Yellowstone that I covered as a journalist, or the Wolf Summit in Alaska, where I was also there to write about and, in fact, try to protest the killing that still goes on of the wild wolves, to the horses my father raised and the grizzlies that my grandmother shooed off from her apple butter. So all of this is in that memoir, Build Me an Ark. But I do feel very privileged to have had this past and wanted to share it with those who have either had it themselves or long for it.
Mm. You write, amid all the politics of timber and conservation, there is something sorely missing. Who are the trees? Not what are the trees, but who are the trees?
You know, one of my great teachers, my writing teachers, Rachel McKenzie, who was at the New Yorker when I was there, used to say, if you can't explain why, then explain how. And one of the things that has happened in my lifetime is that the old growth trees here in the West have fallen, 80% of them have fallen. And in the Forest Service where I grew up, and I watched many, many wonderful men and women come to the forest in the hope of spending their lifetime with the trees and end up becoming timber managers. My father ended up moving to Harvard and going to Washington and becoming the chief of the Forest Service for quite a few years during the Carter administration. And now he's still in wildlife, working very hard to pass all sorts of wildlife legislation. But I think it has been a tragedy in my family's life and in many of those who have been part of the forest and the wildlife to see the incredible short-sightedness of each administration that sees the forest as nothing more than utilitarian. And it's the same way we look at plants. We don't think about beauty. We don't think about something existing because it's beautiful. It must always serve us. And that's where I hope women can speak to these issues by becoming very involved and looking at the natural world as part of our family.
Hmm. Does cutting an old-growth forest continue?
Absolutely. And the latest Bush administration has been merciless in terms of salvage riders and trying to push the timber interests that have elected him. Here we are out in the West with the last remaining old growth, really in the nation. People come from all over the world to see the Arctic Refuge, to see the old growth in the Hope Peninsula, which is on the coast. They come here because we are the only ones who have preserved it. And we still look at it in terms of timber yield and how we can make it work for us instead of preserving it for our next generations.
Hmm. You mentioned that many folks that go out west so that they can be surrounded by Mother Nature wind up in the timber industry. Hmm. And this question that I have to ask here relates to that because, you know, as I'm reading Killing Our Elders or as I'm reading a poem called Alder, I'm wondering, you know, the people who are actually out there cutting, who are working in the timber industry, what do they think about as they work?
I've spent a lot of time actually mediating and as a journalist doing freelance for the Seattle Times writing about this for about the past 10 years. And I do not think, I really don't proceed from the opinion that these timber poachers or timber cutters are evil. I do think they get into a mindset that is they don't want to work in the city. They don't want to have an office job. They don't want to look out a window at bricks. So how can they stay in their area? And the only jobs that have been traditionally available to these people who really want to stay in the wild have been jobs that utilize the resources of that wild, whether that's wildlife management, two words that always send me screeching off, and the other is timber yield or timber cutting. I have quite a few friends who are in the Forest Service who are staying in the Forest Service because they know if they leave, it will really be left to the people who are only concerned with cutting. And, you know, if you have an administration like the Reagan administration, which was the most relentless administration we've had so far in terms of getting the yield out, then they just follow orders and they get into a situation where they can't leave. If they leave, they would have to get a new skill. There are quite a few people who have actually, in the Washington state where I live, been retrained. and done quite well. There's all sorts of programs to teach them new skills. The irony is often they have to leave the forest. So I think we have to look at the system that says the only way to stay in the wild is to use it or to in some way cut it down. If we had a very different mindset, and that's where this book comes in and all of my work, and I think Linda's work as well, many of us nature writers out there are trying to say, is there another way to look at wilderness besides a selfish, greedy way? Is there a way to look at it that can change the way we then are in relationship to it? And I think the key word is relationship.
Mm-hmm. This is a question that you ask in Killing Our Elders. What is our connection to trees on a deeper level than product? And I think, so many of the pieces in this book do just that. They get us to think about connection,
yes,
our connections to plants. And there is a wonderful poem that I think our listeners here in the Midwest will really enjoy. It's titled Corn Mother. And this is a wonderful poem because it makes so many connections between people and plant. The poet is Anita Andreze. I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly.
That's very close.
Okay. What is the correct pronunciation?
Andreze.
Andreze. Muy
she
bien.
Is, she is Mexican and Yaqui Indian. And this is a poem we're particularly proud of with my native co-editor, Linda Hogan, who is Chickasaw. One of our deep concerns was bringing into this book native wisdom, which so often, like female wisdom, has been left out of books on anything, basically. History, plants, animals, peoples. And Anita is writing in a great tradition, and I can almost see those high cornfields there that you must have in the Midwest. We have little cornfields here on the coast, but this is dedicated to all of us who live by corn. Corn Mother. Beneath Mexico City, there is a lake sealed tightly below concrete boulevards and buildings of blind glass. Windows where the pigeons batter their wings and the cleaning women press damp cloths, dreaming of the lake beneath the city where skulls have been crushed into mud and the long paths out of the palaces, markets where the ripe fruit rotted, tables where chocolate pots tipped over, unattended, bone ladies clinking to the floor. Where are we? Stories above the lake and the dead Aztecs, who were kinsmen of the Yaquis, in some northern desert way. And I won't pause because history didn't. If you know your history, you know that Cortez killed thousands of people by sword, hunger, sickness, and all their bones fell into the lake, the water of floating gardens. So, drill into the sediment, and this is what you'll find. Jade flute music, bamboo combs, a woman's shy whisper, small clay statues, a woman giving birth in a warm bath, a hunchbacked old man touching earth with the palms of his hands. In his oath to the earth, royal seals with jaguars and jugulars. Drill deeper into the core. These are the grasses, tacinte, gramine, zay, maize, maize, corn. 20,000 years ago, the seeds inherited the hands of women. They cultivated the shaggy heads, the sacred ears, so that humans became the same flesh. 6,500 B.C., they sifted soil over Mexica and gave corn a family, maize, beans, squash. Maize journeyed to Ontario, Canada before 1200 A.D., blue corn, yellow corn, white corn, black corn. Table 1. Corn, endosperm, germ, pericarp, tip cap, 16% moisture, wain, sweat, prayers, 72% starch, sun, moon, fingerprints, 10% protein, Indian flesh, corn mother, the Virgin of Guadalupe. Zinc, good for your immune system. Iron, improves your blood, whether full blood, mestizo, or other. Aluminum, phosphorus, potassium, boron. Chant these minerals like a prayer with both hands folded over the earth. Blue corn, tortillas, piki, paper bread. You can write on this with the hieroglyphics of your teeth. Chiquiqui, cornmeal mush. Atole, cornmeal drink. Cornflakes, syrup, chips for salsa. Muffins, popcorn, pancakes, polenta. Table 2. Set plates the color of polished sun for the three sisters. One loves to eat corn on the cob, slathered with butter, sprinkled with salt. She props her elbows on the table, leans over the plate, and grins, corn sticking between her teeth. One loves to eat spoonfuls of yellow squash. Later, she takes the dried gourd and carves out a door, like the mouth of a woman surprised in a dark window, as a lover plays a jade flute. She hangs the gourd up in a willow so that small brown birds nest and sleep warm in the belly of a sister. And one loves to cook beans as she sings away the day's complaints, red, black, white, pinto, kidney, green, lima, butter, navy, frijole, spotted, striped, all snapped like Nahuatl vowels. Set the table for the corn mother and her family. Alamo, Uton, Curry, Santa Ana, Taos, Rose, Best, Average, Yellow, White, Kinsman. To prepare corn, boil it in lime. It dissolves flesh and bone, and water ancient as language. Steep overnight while the moon is an Aztec calendar, dividing centuries into the green silk body of the Virgin of Guadalupe, her chocolat sex, her serpent-skirted hips, her yellow tacinte heart. In the morning, take two dark reeds, pound it into paper, and using ink from beans, write poems about maize. Then throw out the liquid, rinse, discard the splattered blood of innocent cracked kernels. Drain, wash, drain. Grind with stone in a skull bowl. Grind for 500 years until the flour is fine as Indian bones and shape into hands, brown faces, virgins and mothers, small icons of corn women carrying bags of groceries in Los Angeles, Guaymas, Spokane, Portland, Seattle.
Mm. Lovely. Thank you very much. That was Corn Mother, the poet Anita Andreze. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Brenda Peterson. She read Corn Mother for us this afternoon. She is co-editor with Linda Hogan of The Sweet Breathing of Plants, Women Riding on the Green World. Listeners, you're invited to join our conversation this afternoon. Give us a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, our number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Brenda Peterson, Corn Mother is I'm in love with that poem.
I'll tell her.
It's a wonderful poem about history, and it's I want to say it is like a prayer of thanksgiving.
Yes, yes. Oh. And the thanksgiving, of course, in our country comes from the Indians who lent us their wisdom of plants and their harvest knowledge and celebrated us with us. And that's why I think this, in every one of these books, Intimate Nature, The Bond Between Women and Animals, and The Plant Book, the native section is one that we're so proud of. You know, Linda is a wonderful fiction writer as well as a poet. Her latest book is the memoir, The Woman Who Watches Over the World, which was just profiled in Oprah magazine. But basically, she really is someone who has spent an entire life both as a native woman and as a person who's on the United Nations Board for Endangered Species. So like Anita, like several of the women in the book, she also has a deep voice that is connected to the natural world. And I think that native wisdom can never be lost again.
Mm. Why don't you read one of one of the contributions that, that Linda has made to the book, Bamboo.
Oh, I'd love to. I'd love to.
On page 57.
This is a poem that Linda was shy about putting in the book, but our very wonderful editor, Becky Salatan at Farrar Straus, insisted, as did I, and I'm very glad it's here. It's called Bamboo. First woman was made of slender bones, like these that stand upright together in the rich green world of daylight. At night, they are a darkened forest of sisters who grow quickly in moving water and talk in the clattering breeze, as if each is an open throat rising to speak. I tell a man about this beautiful creaking world, how it flowers all at once. He has been to war. He says, with bamboo, they do terrible things to men and women. I look at this bamboo. It did not give permission to soldiers. It is imprisoned in its own skin. The stalks are restless about this. They have lived too long in the world of men. They are hollow inside. Lord, are you listening to this? Plants are climbing to heaven to talk to you.
Bamboo, Linda Hogan, read by Brenda Peterson. Why was she shy about including this?
I think it's the native way. You know, we have this discussion. I've known her for 10 years, and we've worked together on many projects. We just finished a project for National Geographic on the gray whale, and we traveled up and down the coast for the last 6 years. I think the native way, unlike the Western way, particularly the American way, is to always think of the tribe first. It's not about individual success. It really is about the collective and the next generation. So she would always be shy about putting herself forward too much. Fortunately, we prevailed in our American way for her to speak this bamboo. But I have so much respect for these people who are always thinking about the collective, more so than their own advancement.
Yeah. Whose idea was this trilogy of books on women in nature?
It was Linda's idea. I told her this morning when I was going off to do this interview. She lives in Colorado, and she's gardening today. That's her way of celebrating the post-fourth fireworks. She lives in the mountains in the Rockies and is working on a brand new garden. And what happened is that Linda and I came together when we were both working on these memoirs. I was working on Build Me an Ark. She was working on Women Who Watches Over the World. And we were at an Everglades nature writers conference and had just spent a lot of time with dolphins underwater, which was my area of research. And we were driving in the Everglades, and she told me that she had actually seen in her travels in the Everglades a river otter crossing the road on its hind legs. And that was the beginning of her novel Power, that image, which was so strong it set her into a study of native peoples in Florida and the Florida panther. And I was working on dolphins for Build Me an Ark, and we were driving on this very late night. I don't know if you've ever been or any of your listeners have been to the Everglades. It really is an astonishing other world. It's not been built upon because everything they build sinks. You know, the plant life is almost like an extraterrestrial experience there. We haven't been able to utilize the Everglades as much as we would like to. We still have managed, of course, to destroy much of it, but we haven't been able to corrupt it completely. So you can take these long drives, and there are tribes there. There are long reservation kind of highways. And there's the Everglades National Park, which is a stunning place. And we were driving late at night. We'd spent all afternoon underwater in the wild with some wild bottlenose dolphins. So we were already kind of in another world. And Linda said, I think we should invite other women to talk about what we talk about in our conversations. And I said, okay, I can call Diane Ackerman. You know, I can call, she said she could call Joy Harjo. We kind of came up with a group of people. And then she said, I don't want to just do animals, Brenda. I want to do plants and God. I said, oh, yeah, well, what's left? And I said, that's too big. That's too much. You know, that's three anthologies. You know, we can barely make a living as it is, much less become editors. And she said, I think we should do this for the natural world. I think we should do it for all the women who are working out there, unsung, who aren't being used to balance the traditional masculine engineering mind. And I think we should start with all of the women who are working with animals, from Jane Goodall to someone we'd heard about who was raising black rhinos in Kenya, hand-raising them, to Birute Galdikas, who's working with orangutans. And then I want to turn to plants, and I actually said, I'm only a vegetable gardener. I don't know anything about flowers. And she said, everybody else does. So that was the beginning, and it's been since 1994, actually, we've been working on this, and now we're about to deliver the manuscript of Women and God in November. Mm. So it's been a long labor of love, and we are so honored to have been joined in this work by both unknown writers and very well-established writers.
Mm. I hope when the third book comes out, I don't know if this is practical or not, but it would be lovely if all three of them were available in a set.
I wish I had a tape recording. I would send this to my editor. That would be our hope. I think the idea of a trilogy or a triptych or whatever has always appealed to me. I also think one of the most gratifying experiences of these anthologies has been that when we've gone on book tours and we've gone to universities, people come up, male and female, and tell us that these books are being taught in biology classes, in anthropology classes. And I have to say that some of these scientists, these women and men in the science fields, weep when they come up to us, because there's just nothing like it being done.
Mm. Talking about science, let's talk about a profile of a scientist from St. Louis by the name of Barbara McClintock, who's in the book. Prior to editing this book, were you aware of her?
Absolutely. I had read the biography of her, A Feeling for the Organism, and I had heard stories about her that she was completely dismissed when she was younger and in college, and she was a maverick. And as somewhat of a maverick myself, growing up in the Forest Service, where it was a paramilitary organization basically dealing with the forest, and being a woman, I really needed heroes. Rachel Carson was there, you know. Barbara McClintock was there from a very young age with me, and I really looked to her as a grandmother, as a mentor. Mm. So we were very happy to find this wonderful piece by Sharon McGrain profiling her.
Mm. Well, I want to thank you for the introduction to Barbara McClintock. She did groundbreaking work on chromosomes. What else should we know about her before you read an excerpt from the profile?
I think you should know that if she had been a man with her brilliance and her iconoclasm, she would have probably been much celebrated and at the top of every reading list for any botany or horticulture or forestry class. But because she was kind of a drifter, because she never really followed the academic ladder, because she really was more of a poet about corn, she actually listened to corn. And when she won the Nobel Prize for Science, which was quite a feat, she actually explained that she, you know, everyone said, how did you come to this knowledge of corn and genetics? And she said, I listened to it. And I think that is such a profound, if we listened to forests, we couldn't cut them down the way we do. If we listened to the natural world in this kind of really wrapped, Simone Weil, I think you might know her, the great French Jewish mystic, said that prayer is rapt attention. So that's how I think Barbara McClintock, she might not have said it quite that way, but she said, I listened. Mm. And all of you radio people, you bless you for being listeners.
Well, we would love to listen to you read from this profile of Barbara McClintock.
Celeste, would you like me to read all the way to page 160 on this?
What I'm thinking about is starting at 158, where we learn that she was at the top of American science when she quit it, although she didn't quit it for long. And then continue on to the maybe about the midpoint on page 160.
Fine. McClintock was at the top of American science when she quit it. She had revolutionized male genetics. One of her early experiments still ranks among the 20th century's most important biological experiments. She was the vice president of the Genetic Society of America and was about to become its president. She had not yet done her Nobel Prize-winning project, but she had already received an honorary doctorate from a well-known university and would soon be elected to the National Academy of Sciences, then the nation's highest scientific honor. McClintock's vigor, intensity, and enthusiasm marked her as special. And by the time she graduated in 1923, she was already deep in graduate work. So were many other young American women. Between 30% and 40% of all graduate students in the United States during the 1920s were women. In fact, women accounted for approximately 12% of the science and engineering PhDs awarded in the U.S., a proportion they would not reach again until the 1970s. Most studied biology, and almost one in five was a botanist. A goodly number of them specialized in genetics. Most of the rest were in zoology and psychology, which required little mathematics. Getting a good science education, however, was much easier than getting a research job. Industry, government, and most colleges and universities refused to hire women. Most women scientists taught in women's colleges, where teaching loads were heavy and research time was short. Only 4% of women scientists in the U.S. were employed by co-educational colleges and universities, and they were concentrated in home economics and physical education, and in low-ranking positions as assistant instructors and assistant professors. Genetics, however, was a wide-open field. McClintock and genetics were born and raised together. Gregor Mendel's studies of heredity in garden peas were rediscovered in 1900, just 2 years before McClintock's birth. By the 1920s, genetics was America's first world-class science and biology's most abstract specialty. When McClintock entered graduate school in 1923, many biologists still did not accept Mendelian genetics. The word gene had been coined, but it had no clear definition or physical reality. It was just an abstract concept and controversial theory describing the way inherited traits are passed from one generation to another. As Thomas Hunt Morgan put it, geneticists assumed there is something in the egg that is responsible for every detail of character that later develops out of the egg. As McClintock began her career, fruit flies and corn were vying as geneticists' leading research tools. Cornell geneticists worked with corn. Scientifically known as Zea maize, corn is an economically important crop. It was an ideal research tool, too. The variegated colors of its kernels functioned like a technicolor spreadsheet of genetic data. Genetic changes were as plain as the kernels on the cob. Furthermore, maize could be self-fertilized, inbred to produce tightly controlled extremes of genetic behavior. Each maize plant produces both male and female flowers. Female flowers born on the ear contain egg cells. Male flowers produced in the tassel at the top of the stalk contain sperm cells, known as pollen. When spring-planted corn reached sexual maturity in July, Cornell's geneticists began working from dawn to dark, 7 days a week, to control the mating. Normally, wind wafts pollen from the tassel of one plant to the silk of another. There, a pollen grain germinates, growing a long phallic tube down through a silk to carry the sperm to the egg at the bottom of the cob. Sperm and egg cells fuse, starting the next generation seed, a kernel on the cob. Each fertilization produces one kernel. To prevent random promiscuity, geneticists cover the ears and tassels with paper bags and transfer the pollen to the silk by hand. To self-fertilize a plant and inbreed exotic strains, they fertilize the silk of one plant with its own pollen. Despite the attractions of maize as a research tool, Cornell's geneticists had not studied its chromosomes. They had no way to identify which chromosomes carried which inherited traits. working in the botany department because Cornell's plant breeders refused to have a woman in their department, McClintock devised a system. Using new staining techniques, she discovered that each of the 10 chromosomes in maize could be distinguished under a microscope by their tiny knobs, extensions, and constrictions. Then she went on to identify each chromosome with a group of visible traits that are generally inherited together. By plotting the probability of these traits appearing together, she mapped the position of the genes on the chromosomes, just as Morgan had done with the fruit fly. At first, none of her Cornell colleagues understood her project. Then, Marcus Rhodes, who had earned his Ph.D. with Morgan, came to Cornell. Rhodes immediately realized how good McClintock was. Hell, he said, it was so damn obvious. She was something special. Immediately he asked McClintock, "Can I join you?" Then Rhodes, her champion, interpreter, and soulmate for decades to come, explained the importance of McClintock's work to Cornell.
Wonderful.
This was written by Sharon McGrain, who also wrote the book Nobel Prize-Winning Women in Science, and it's also, I think it's such a well-written, easily accessible look at science and the women who have won the Nobel Prize.
Yeah. I love the way she writes about McClintock's work and describes chromosomes and DNA as so poetically. I mean, the variegated colors of its kernels function like a technicolor spreadsheet of genetic data. Genetic changes were as plain as the kernels on the cob.
Also the promiscuity yes. of the corn. All of those corn people out there in those huge cornfields, I can just see them now, never again entering their cornfields without listening and knowing just what's going on around them.
And how important Barbara McClintock is, Amen. Has been to their prosperity.
Yes.
With each discovery, Barbara McClintock, it seems, her curiosity continued to grow. She never sat down and said, "Now I'm finished."
No. I think like most true, I have great respect for the academic world. I've taught there, I've left there, but I do think that while it often supports research, it often denies it, as Cornell did when they couldn't understand what she was doing. So mainly I think the academic world supports and nurtures the status quo. And the work being done outside the university, whether it's Einstein or Barbara McClintock or some of the native science peoples that we talk about in this book, it really is often the loner who, like McClintock, like a tumbleweed, kind of traveled around following her passion for plants, and she'd drive a beat-up old car and drive to the West Coast as a woman when most women were just worried about home economics and Betty Crocker. She really claimed the natural world as her natural habitat, and that's what we're trying to do in all of these books, is really ask women. You know, one of my friends who's a therapist tells this joke that when men want to save the world, they join the Peace Corps, and when women want to save the world, they marry an alcoholic. And I think there you have it. We need to think a little larger. We need to think about our family being the extended family of animals, plants, water. And the more women who get involved and who brave these biological conferences or these wolf summits or these places that has been the territory not only of men, but usually of managers, farmers, and hunters. And that's the imagination that has shaped the natural world for almost all of our inherited memory. And if women began to, like Barbara McClintock, go into places where they are not usually allowed, they necessarily, like Jane Goodall, like McClintock, change what they see. And that's what we're asking, not to deny or compete with the masculine mind, but to balance it.
Hmm. Brenda Peterson is our guest this afternoon. Together with Linda Hogan, she is co-editor of The Sweet Breathing of Plants, Women Writing on the Green World. The book is the second in a trilogy on women in the natural world. This volume, The Sweet Breathing of Plants, follows intimate nature, the bond between women and animals. We have just a few more minutes in this portion of the program this afternoon. If you would like to talk with us, now's the time. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. There's such a variety of pieces in this book. You read two poems and a section of the profile of Barbara McClintock, written by Sharon McGrain. There's also a piece in the book about mold.
Yes, one of my favorites.
Ode to Mold, and a poem about mulch. there's a wonderful essay, again, mentioning Native American women on peyote.
Mm-hmm.
How did you go about the work of choosing the pieces for the sweet breathing of plants? I imagine it was difficult.
There was so much. We didn't really even know how much there was out there. We probably had about 300 submissions. And then, you know, we put it out through the grapevine, so to speak, which the Internet is a wonderful... I always think of the Internet as something organic and like a grapevine. Heard it through the grapevine. And then we had all sorts of... we had some researchers who helped us, some interns, like some of my students, some of Linda's students, who went into these formidable library shelves and found some interesting things. So it took us about 3 years, and when we made the final decision, I flew to Colorado with a giant suitcase with the manuscript, and Linda had her choices, and we sat in her beautiful garden in the springtime, and we went through piece by piece, and it took us quite a few days, but we were so lucky to have so much to choose from. It was like a cornucopia. It was like a diverse bouquet, and the difficulty was saying no to some of the mm-hmm. people we really, really loved.
Mm.
But this Ode to Mold is one of my personal favorites because it's funny. And just as in Intimate Nature, where at one point one of our co-authors, Dina Metzger, at one point we had to say, oh, Dina, it's becoming a wailing wall of slain animals. You know, we really need to have other views of animals. And so then we balanced it with playful pieces, with nurturing pieces. With this, it wasn't so emotionally difficult because plants have not been, there hasn't really been a holocaust against plants as there has been against animals. There, of course, was a holocaust against plants, women. In old Europe, where 9 million herbalists and yarb doctors and midwives were, of course, put down with the Inquisition, and that knowledge was lost, and we have a piece about that in the book. And so we needed to balance everything, and when we got to Ode to Mold, we just loved the idea of this woman who said, I don't know anything about plants, but in my refrigerator I seem to be growing these marvelous things. And so that was a funny piece. The mulch poem by Lyndall Hasselstrom is really wonderful because she talks about mulching an old lover. that's quite a wonderful thing to ponder for those of us who have old lovers. And there are surprises, too. I think another one of my favorites is Laura Bowers Foreman, who wrote about being a woman who, like many of my Forest Service friends, loved trees and ended up at Weyerhaeuser. And her rebellion was to mark the trees that should have been destroyed because they were so diverse. And while she was at Weyerhaeuser marking trees, a lot of them did not get cut. She finally had to leave and go into grassroots native plant preservation.
Mm.
But there are wonderful pieces. There's a piece by Donna Kelleher on holistic medicine through herbs for animals. She's a holistic
mm-hmm.
vet. There are surprises, and that's, we really wanted very unusual pieces, not the usual suspects. There's Sylvia Earle with The Twilight Zone about underwater plants. There's just some wonderful stuff about radioactive tumbleweeds in eastern Washington, where these women get these Karen Silkwood-like radioactive suits on, and they go out with their pitchforks and take these tumbleweeds and put them in trucks and haul them off because they're blowing across the sagebrush range. So we just really, we had so much fun doing this book and putting together unusual voices and visions.
Mm. I'm sorry we don't have more time today. Mm. We're out of time. Brenda, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
My pleasure, Celeste.
Brenda Peterson, she and Linda Hogan are the editors of The Sweet Breathing of Plants, Women Writing on the Green World.